one of the very last lines of the book is, I'm paraphrased, there's nothing so expensive as something that's cheap.
One of the things I get into in the book is that, you know, if Walmart is a very easy thing to blame. Cheap is a very easy thing to feel guilty about. And what we're finding is that, you know, is that cheap is in many ways the greenhouse gas of a troubled economy, is that, you know, like carbon emissions, cheap is kind of evidence of prosperity happening. It's evidence of our, you know, sort of in the West, we have a very rich consumer universe. But at the same time, it's come to be a destabilizing force as well. Our pursuit of things that have less value, the usage of new techniques of manufacturing, of logistics, of retailing, and Walmart being sort of the dominant paradigm for today's economy in the way that General Motors once was for a previous generation of workers and shoppers, is that, you know, the principle behind this is reducing the value of a great many things to try to bring us the stuff that we want at a price that cannot be beat. And this has created a, you know, quite a ripple effect, is that, you know, it also means that a lot of the what economists call the externalities, things like carbon or the effects of pollution are kind of obvious examples. But even things like the way that the economy's come to circle around consumer activity as the main driver is that we haven't really come to wrestle fully with what it means to have 70% of our economy tagged to consumer activity one way or the other. It's the so-called, is what's known as the service economy. And a lot of that has been run on unprecedented shipping, shopping, and spending. So it's something that is leveraged on a number of factors of again, cheap labor, cheap shipping, affordable energy, consumer credit that's affordable. None of that is particularly built to last. And so this is what I get into in the book, is that you know, it's been an enormously successful system of getting what we want or getting what we need. But 10 years from now, you know, things are going to be a lot different. They're different now. The current recession, as I argue, is the first of many sets of changes that we're going to be looking at. The analog to climate change for me is very strong, is that the more we neglect the issue, the more it'll cost us in the end.
Yeah, it's like, the good thing about Y2K is it had a deadline.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very careful about not predicting, you know, the wholesale collapse of Western civilization, because I don't think it happens like that. You know, is that we're becoming sort of, inmates of our own system, and you know, the problem, you know, the issue is just to try to give people more options, more choices. I mean, you know, an ecosystem that is that's a monoculture does not last. That's that much we know. So I'm saying our economy has taken that shape. It's taken that shape in a way that's created a lot of prosperity, because we've got these highly leveraged resources happening, transport resources and labor resources and spending resources and energy resources, for example. I mean, it's not the full list. It's really a thing that is in the end trying to give people the ability to choose better things, because I think people do aspire to that. And our natural systems often, more often than not, surprise us with their own resilience. I mean, nature has a lot of strength in it. And so, you know, that's one reason why, you know, when oil spikes to 150, our economy doesn't collapse. It certainly becomes a little disabled. It's certainly, you know, a lot of change does start to happen. I mean, shipping rates go way up. The price of rice, there's lineups for food in some places. So it gives us a taste of what could be happening further on down the century. But it also shows us that it doesn't come to a complete standstill either. And so we do have a bit of wiggle room in the situation. So I'm careful not to, you know, sort of be the sort of crazy futurist who's predicting a collapse unless we go to my utopian plan. I think it's really about trying to see things better and more engaged and see things more correctly, because you know, ultimately, it's not really a crisis of wealth, because we found billions to rescue the banks and to create stimulus dollars, some of which aren't going to really amount to much in the future. They just put money in the economy, building rinks and, you know, infrastructure that we're probably needed, but, you know, it doesn't really get us a competitive advantage in the new century. But we find the money when we need to for transformations. And it's not really a crisis of ingenuity. I mean, certainly there's an ingenuity gap, as Thomas Homer Dixon has identified, but we have a pretty good grasp of what probably is happening. It's really, I think, you know, owning up to the fact that we're choosing not to see things fully. It's a crisis of view. You know, is that our place in the world is changing, and, you know, places like China are assuming dominancy, and there's a sort of a geopolitical context for that. Our power as consumers is changing as well, because the system's not set up to let us win, and probably less so in the coming years. And certainly it's clear that governments, like consumers, are conflicted as well, and so there's a whole democratic aspect to this. So when we talk about something like climate change, it's obviously has to be, you know, there's an aspect of needing governments and nations in that. But as people identify more with the issue, if we ignore this fact, it's at our own peril.
The book is The Price of a Bargain, The Quest for Cheap, and The Death of Globalization. I've been speaking with the author, Gordon Laird, and The Price of a Bargain, published by McClelland and Stewart.